We will be waiting. His finger moved an inch to the left. Here. Here was a hush in the night, moonlight and shadows, a thick carpet of dead leaves underfoot, densely wooded ridges sloping gently down to the stream bed, the underbrush thinning as the ground fell away. Here was her son on a stallion, glancing back at her one last time and lifting his sword in salute. Here was the call of Maige Mormont's war horn, a long, low blast that rolled down the valley from the east to tell them that the last of Jaime's riders had entered the trap. And Grey Wind threw back his head and howled. The sound seemed to go right through Catelyn Stark, and she found herself shivering. It was a terrible sound, a frightening sound. Yet there was music in it, too. For a second, she felt something like pity for the Lannisters below. "So this is what death sounds like," she thought. "Haru!" came the answer from the far ridge, as the Great John winded his own horn. To east and west, the trumpets of the Malisters and Freys blew vengeance. North, where the valley narrowed and bent like a cocked elbow, Lord Carstark's war horns added their own deep, mournful voices to the dark chorus. Men were shouting and horses rearing in the stream below. The whispering wood let out its breath all at once, as the bowmen Rob had hidden in the branches of the trees let fly their arrows, and the night erupted with the screams of men and horses. All around her, the riders raised their lances, and the dirt and leaves that had buried the cruel bright points fell away to reveal the gleam of sharpened steel. "Winterfell!" she heard Rob shout as the arrow sighed again. He moved away from her at a trot, leading his men downhill. Catelyn sat on her horse, unmoving, with Hal Mullen and her guard around her, and she waited as she had waited before, for Brandon and Ned and her father. She was high on the ridge, and the trees hid most of what was going on beneath her. A heartbeat. Two, four, and suddenly it was as if she and her protectors were alone in the wood. The rest were melted away into the green. Yet when she looked across the valley to the far ridge, she saw the Great John's riders emerge from the darkness beneath the trees. They were in a long line, an endless line, and as they burst from the wood, there was an instant, the smallest part of a heartbeat, but all Catelyn saw was the moonlight on the points of their lances, as if a thousand will-o'-wisps were coming down the ridge, wreathed in silver flame. Then she blinked, and they were only men, rushing down to kill or die. Afterward, she could not claim she had seen the battle, yet she could hear, and the valley rang with echoes, the crack of a broken lance, the clash of swords, the cries of "Lannister!" and "Winterfell!" and "Tully! River Run and Tully!" When she realized there was no more to see, she closed her eyes and listened. The battle came alive around her. She heard hoofbeats, iron boots splashing in shallow water, the woody sound of swords on oaken shields, and the scrape of steel against steel, the hiss of arrows, the thunder of drums, the terrified screaming of a thousand horses. Men shouted curses and begged for mercy, and got it or not, and lived or died. The ridges seemed to play queer tricks with sound. Once she heard Rob's voice, as clear as if he'd been standing at her side, calling, "To me! To me!" And she heard his direwolf snarling and growling, heard the snap of those long teeth, the tearing of flesh, shrieks of fear and pain for man and horse alike. Was there only one wolf? It was hard to be certain. Little by little, the sounds dwindled and died, until at last there was only the wolf. As a red dawn broke in the east, Grey Wind began to howl again. Rob came back to her on a different horse, riding a piebald gelding in the place of the grey stallion he had taken down into the valley. The wolf's head and his shield were slashed half to pieces, raw wood showing where deep gouges had been hacked in the oak. But Rob himself seemed unhurt. Yet when he came closer, Catelyn saw that his mail glove and the sleeve of his surcoat were black with blood. "You're hurt," she said. Rob lifted his hand, opened, and closed his fingers. "No," he said, "this is, Taran's blood, perhaps, or, He shook his head. "I do not know." A mob of men followed him up the slope, dirty and dented and grinning, with Theon and the great John at their head. Between them they dragged Sir Jaime Lannister. They threw him down in front of her horse. "The Kingslayer," Hal announced, unnecessarily. Lannister raised his head. "Lady Stark," he said from his knees. Blood ran down one cheek from a gash across his scalp, but the pale light of dawn had put the glint of gold back in his hair. "I would offer you my sword, but I seem to have mislaid it." "It is not your sword I want, sir," she told him. "Give me my father and my brother Edmure. Give me my daughters. Give me my lord husband." "I have mislaid them as well, I fear." "A pity," Catelyn said coldly. "Kill him, Rob," Theon Greyjoy urged. "Take his head off." "No," her son answered, peeling off his bloody glove. "He's more use alive than dead, and my lord father never condoned the murder of prisoners after a battle." "A wise man," Jaime Lannister said. "An honourable." "Take him away and put him in irons," Catelyn said. "Do as my lady mother says," Rob commanded, "and make certain there's a strong guard around him. Lord Carstark will want his head on a pike." "That he will," the Great John agreed, gesturing. Lannister was led away to be bandaged and chained. "Why should Lord Carstark want him dead?" Catelyn asked. Rob looked away into the woods with the same brooding look that Ned often got. He killed them. "Lord Carstark's sons," Galbert Glover explained. "Both of them," Rob said. "Torrin and Eddard. And Darren Hornwood as well." "No one can fault Lannister on his courage," Glover said. "When he saw that he was lost, he rallied his retainers and fought his way up the valley, hoping to reach Lord Rob and cut him down. And almost did. He mislaid his sword in Eddard Carstark's neck, after he took Torrin's hand off and split Darren Hornwood's skull open," Rob said. "All the time he was shouting for me. If they hadn't tried to stop him, I should then be mourning in place of Lord Carstark," Catelyn said. "Your men did what they were sworn to do, Rob. They died protecting their liege lord. Grieve for them. Honour them for their valour. But not now. You have no time for grief. You may have lopped off the head of the snake, but three-quarters of the body is still coiled around my father's castle. We have won a battle, not a war." "But such a battle," said Theon Greyjoy eagerly. "My lady, the realm has not seen such a victory since a field of fire. I vow the Lannisters lost 10 men for every one of ours that fell. We've taken close to 100 knights captive, and 12 Lords Bannermen, Lord Westerling, Lord Bainfort, Sir Garth Greenfield, Lord Estrin, Sir Titus Drax, Mallow the Dornishman, and 3 Lannisters besides Jaime, Lord Tywin's own nephews, 2 of his sister's sons, and 1 of his dead brothers, and Lord Tywin." Catelyn interrupted. "Have you perchance taken Lord Tywin, Theon?"
No,
Greyjoy answered, brought up short. "Until you do, this war is far from done." Rob raised his head and pushed his hair back out of his eyes. "My mother is right. We still have River Run." Daenerys. The flies circled Khal Drogo slowly, their wings buzzing, a low thrum at the edge of hearing that filled Danny with dread. The sun was high and pitiless. Heat shimmered in waves off the stony outcrops of low hills. A thin finger of sweat trickled slowly down between Danny's swollen breasts. The only sounds were the steady clop of their horses' hooves, the rhythmic tingle of the bells in Drogo's hair, and the distant voices behind them. Danny watched the flies. They were as large as bees, gross, purplish, glistening. The Dothraki called them blood flies. They lived in marshes and stagnant pools, sucked blood for man and horse alike, and laid their eggs in the dead and dying. Drogo hated them. Whenever one came near him, his hand would shoot out quick as a striking snake to close around it. She had never seen him miss. He would hold the fly inside his huge fist long enough to hear its frantic buzzing. Then his fingers would tighten, and when he opened his hand again, the fly would be only a red smear on his palm. Now one crept across the rump of his stallion, and the horse gave an angry flick of its tail to brush it away. The others flitted about Drogo, closer and closer. The carl did not react. His eyes were fixed on distant brown hills, the reins loose in his hands. Beneath his painted vest, a plaster of fig leaves and cake-blue mud covered the wound on his breast. The herb woman had made it for him. Miri Mazdur's poultice had itched and burned, and he had torn it off 6 days ago, cursing her for a meji. The mud plaster was more soothing, and the herb woman made him poppy wine as well. He'd been drinking it heavily these past 3 days. When it was not poppy wine, it was fermented mare's milk, or pepper beer. Yet he scarcely touched his food, and he thrashed and groaned in the night. Danny could see how drawn his face had become. Rago was restless in her belly, kicking like a stallion. Yet even that did not stir Drogo's interest as it had. Every morning her eyes found fresh lines of pain on his face when he woke from his troubled sleep. And now, this silence, it was making her afraid. Since they had mounted up at dawn, he had not said a word. When she spoke, she got no answer but a grunt, and not even that much since midday. One of the blood flies landed on the bare skin of the carl's shoulder. Another, circling, touched down on his neck and crept up towards his mouth. Khal Drogo swayed in the saddle, bells ringing, as his stallion kept onward at a steady walking pace. Danny pressed her heels into her silver and rode closer. "My lord," she said softly, "Drogo, my sun and stars." He did not seem to hear. The blood fly crawled up under his drooping moustache and settled on his cheek in the crease beside his nose. Danny gasped, "Drogo!" Clumsily she reached over and touched his arm. Khal Drogo reeled in the saddle, tilted slowly, and fell heavily from his horse. The flies scattered for a heartbeat, and then circled back to settle on him where he lay. "No!" Danny said, reining up. Heedless of her belly for once, she scrambled off her silver and ran to him. The grass beneath him was brown and dry. Drogo cried out in pain as Danny knelt beside him. His breath rattled harshly in his throat, and he looked at her without recognition.
"My horse!"
he gasped. Danny brushed the flies off his chest, smashing one, as he would have. His skin burned beneath her fingers. The car's blood riders had been following just behind them. She heard Hago shout as they galloped up. Kaholo vaulted from his horse.
"Blood of my blood," he said as they dropped to his knees. The other two kept to their mounts.
"No,"
Khal Drogo groaned, struggling in Danny's arms.
"Must ride. Ride. No."
"He fell from his horse," Hagar said, staring down. His broad face was impassive, but his voice was leaden. "You must not say that," Danny told him. "We have ridden far enough today. We will camp here."
"Here?"
Hagar looked around him. The land was brown and sere, inhospitable.
"This is no camping ground."
"It is not for a woman to bid us halt," said Kotho. "Not even a Khaleesi."
"We camp here," Danny repeated. "Hagar, tell them Khal Drogo, commander of the halt. If any ask why, say to them that my time is near and I could not continue. Kahalo, bring up the slaves. They must put up the Khal's tent at once. Kotho,
you do not command me, Khaleesi,"
Kotho said. "Find Miramazdua," she told him. "The guard's wife would be walking among the other lamb men in the long column of slaves. Bring her to me, with her chest." Kotho glared down at her, his eyes hard as flint.
"The Magi?"
he spat.
"This I will not do."
"You will," Danny said, "or when Drogo wakes, he will hear why you defied me." Furious, Kotho wheeled his stallion around and galloped off in anger. But Danny knew he would return with Miramazdur, however little he might like it. The slaves erected Khal Drogo's tent beneath a jagged outcrop of black rock, whose shadow gave some relief from the heat of the afternoon sun. Even so, it was stifling under the sand silk, as Iri and Doria helped Danny walk Drogo inside. Thick patterned carpets had been laid down over the ground, and pillows scattered in the corners. Iroa, the timid girl Danny had rescued outside the mud walls of the lamb men, set up a brazier. They stretched Drogo out on a woven mat.
"No,"
he murmured in the common tongue.
"No, no."
It was all he said, all he seemed capable of saying. Daria unhooked his medallion belt and stripped off his vest and leggings, while Jiqui knelt by his feet to undo the laces of his riding sandals. Iri wanted to leave the tent flaps open to let in the breeze, but Danny forbade it. She would not have any see Drogo this way, in delirium and weakness. When her cars came up, she posted them outside at guard. "Admit no one without my leave," she told Jogo. "No one." Iroa stared fearfully at Drogo where he lay.
"He dies,"
she whispered. Danny slapped her. "The Khal cannot die. He is the father of the stallion who mounts the world. His hair has never been cut. He still wears the bells his father gave him." "Khaleesi," Jiqui said, "he fell from his horse." Trembling, her eyes full of sudden tears, Danny turned away from them. He fell from his horse. It was so, she had seen it. And the blood riders, and no doubt her handmaids, and the men of her cars as well. And how many more? They could not keep it secret. And Danny knew what that meant. A Khal who could not ride, could not rule. And Drogo had fallen from his horse. "We must bathe him," she said stubbornly. She must not allow herself to despair. "Iri, have the tub brought at once. Doria, Iroa, find water, cool water. He's so hot." He was a fire in human skin. The slaves set up the heavy copper tub in the corner of the tent. When Doria brought the first jar of water, Danny wet a length of silk to lay across Drogo's brow over the burning skin. His eyes looked at her, but he did not see. When his lips opened, no words escaped them, only a moan. "Where is Miramazdur?" she demanded, her patience rubbed raw with fear.
"Kotho will find her," Iri said.
Her handmaidens filled the tub with tepid water that stank of sulphur, sweetened it with jars of bitter oil and handfuls of crushed mint leaves. While the bath was being prepared, Danny knelt awkwardly beside her lord husband, her belly great with their child within. She undid his braid with anxious fingers, as she had on the night he'd taken her for the first time, beneath the stars. His bells she laid aside carefully, one by one. He would want them again when he was well, she told herself. A breath of air entered the tent as Aego poked his head through the silk. Khaleesia said, "The Andal has come and begs leave to enter." The Andal was what the Dothraki called Ser Jorah. "Yes," she said, rising clumsily, "send him in." She trusted the knight. He would know what to do if anyone did. Ser Jorah Mormont ducked through the door flap and waited a moment for his eyes to adjust to the dimness. In the fierce heat of the south, he wore loose trousers of mottled sand silk and open-toed riding sandals that laced up to his knees. His scabbard hung from a twisted horsehair belt. Under a bleach-white vest, he was bare-chested, skin reddened by the sun. "Talk goes from mouth to ear all over the Kalasar," he said. "It is said Khal Drogo fell from his horse." "Help him," Danny pleaded. "For the love you say you bear me, help him now." The knight knelt beside her. He looked at Drogo, long and hard, and then at Danny. "Send your maids away." Wordlessly, her throat tight with fear, Danny made a gesture. Eerie heard at the other girls from the tent. When they were alone, Ser Jorah drew his dagger. Deftly, with a delicacy surprising in such a big man, he began to scrape away the black leaves and dried blue mud from Drogo's chest. The plaster had caked, hard as the mud walls of the Lamb Men, and like those walls, it cracked easily. Ser Jorah broke the dry mud with his knife, pried the chunks from the flesh, peeling off the leaves one by one. A foul, sweet smell rose from the wound, so thick it almost choked her. The leaves were crusted with blood and pus, Drogo's breast black and glistening with corruption.
"No," Danny whispered as tears ran down her cheeks. "No, please. Gods, hear me. No."
Khal Drogo thrashed, fighting some unseen enemy. Black blood ran slowly and thick from his open wound.
"Your Khal is as good as dead, Princess."
"No, he can't die. He mustn't. It was only a cut."
Danny took his large, calloused hand in her own small ones and held it tight between them.
"I will not let him die."
Ser Jorah gave a bitter laugh.
"Khaleesi, or Queen, that command is beyond your power. Save your tears, child. Weep for him tomorrow or a year from now. We do not have time for grief. We must go, and quickly, before he dies."
Danny was lost.
"Go? Where should we go?"
"Eshai, I would say. It lies far to the south, at the end of the known world, yet men say it is a great port. We will find a ship to take us back to Pentos. It will be a hard journey, make no mistake. Do you trust your cars? Will they come with us?"
"Khal Drogo commanded them to keep me safe," Danny replied uncertainly. "But if he dies..." She touched the swell of her belly.
"I don't understand. Why should we flee? I am Khaleesi. I carry Drogo's heir. He will be Khal after Drogo..."
Ser Jorah frowned. "Princess, hear me. The Dothraki will not follow a suckling babe. Drogo's strength was what they bowed to, and only that. When he is gone, Jaco and Pono and the other Khos will fight for his place, and this Kalasar will devour itself. The winner will want no more rivals. The boy will be taken from your breast the moment he is born. They will give him to the dogs."
Danny hugged herself.
"But why," she cried plaintively, "why should they kill a little baby? He is Drogo's son, and the Khons say he will be the stallion who mounts the world. It was prophesied. Better to kill the child than to risk his fury when he grows to manhood."
The child kicked inside her, as if he had heard. Danny remembered the story Viserys had told her of what the usurper's dogs had done to Rhaegar's children. His son had been a babe as well, yet they had ripped him from his mother's breast and dashed his head against a wall. That was the way of men. "They must not hurt my son," she cried.
I will order my cars to keep him safe, and Drogo's blood riders will—"
Ser Jorah held her by the shoulders.
"A blood rider dies with his cow. You know that, child. They will take you to Vaes Dothrak, to the crones. That is the last duty they owe him in life. When that is done, they will join Drogo in the Nightlands."
Danny did not want to go back to Vaes Dothrak and live the rest of her life among those terrible old women. Yet she knew that the knight spoke the truth. Drogo had been more than her sun and stars. He had been the shield that kept her safe. "I will not leave him," she said stubbornly, miserably. She took his hand again. "I will not." A stirring at the tent flap made Danny turn her head. Miramar's Dua entered, bowing low. Days on the march, trailing behind the Khalasar, had left her limping and haggard, with blistered and bleeding feet and hollows under her eyes. Behind her came Kotho and Hagar, carrying the god's wife's chest between them. When the blood riders caught sight of Drogo's wound, the chest slipped from Hagar's fingers and crashed to the floor of the tent, and Kotho swore an oath so foul it seared the air. Miramar's Dua studied Drogo, her face still and dead.
"The wound has festered."
"This is your work, Meji," Kotho said. Hagar laid his fist across Miri's cheek with a meaty smack that drove her to the ground. Then he kicked her where she lay.
"Stop it!" Danny screamed.
Kotho pulled Hagar away, saying, "Kicks are too merciful for a Meji. Take her outside. We will stake her to the earth to be the mount of every passing man. And when they are done with her, the dogs will use her as well. Weasels will tear out her entrails, and carrion crows feast upon her eyes. The flies off the river shall lay their eggs in her womb and drink pus from the ruins of her breasts."
He dug iron-hard fingers into the soft, wobbly flesh under the god's wife's arm and hauled her to her feet.
"No," Danny said. "I will not have her harmed."
Kotho's lips skinned back from his crooked brown teeth in a terrible mockery of a smile.
"No? You say me no? Better you should pray that we do not stake you outside beside your Meji. You did this as much as the other."
Ser Jorah stepped between them, loosening his long sword in its scabbard.
"Rein in your tongue, blood rider. The princess is still your Khaleesi."
"Only while the blood of my blood still lives," Kotho told the knight. "When he dies, she is nothing."
Danny felt a tightness inside her. "Before I was Khaleesi, I was the blood of the dragon. Ser Jorah, summon my cars."
"No," said Kotho. "We will go. For now, Khaleesi."
Hagar followed him from the tent, scowling.
"That one means you no good, princess," Mormont said. "The Dothraki say a man and his blood riders share one life, and Kotho sees it ending. A dead man is beyond fear."
"No one has died," Danny said. "Ser Jorah, I may have need of your blade. Best go don your armor." She was more frightened than she dared admit, even to herself. The knight bowed.
"As you say."
He strode from the tent. Danny turned back to Miramar's Dua. The woman's eyes were weary.
"So he has saved me once more."
"And now you must save him," Danny said. "Please."
"You do not ask a slave,"
Miri replied sharply.
"You tell her."
She went to Drogo, burning on his mat, and gazed long at his wound.
"Ask or tell, it makes no matter. He is beyond a healer's skills."
The cow's eyes were closed. She opened one with her fingers.
"He has been dulling the hurt with milk of the puppy."
"Yes," Danny admitted.
"I made him a poultice of fire pod and sting-me-nut and bound it in a lambskin."
"It burned," he said. "He tore it off. The herb women made him a new one, wet and soothing."
"It burned, yes. There is great healing magic in fire. Even your hairless men know that."
"'Make him another poultice,' Danny begged. "'This time I will make certain he wears it.'
"'The time for that is past, my lady,'
Mary said.
"'All I can do now is ease the dark road before him, "'so that he might ride painless to the Nightlands. "'He will be gone by morning.'
Her words were a knife through Danny's breast. What has she ever done to make the guard so cruel? She had finally found a safe place, had finally tasted love and hope. She was finally going home. And now, to lose it all? No, she pleaded, save him, and I will free you, I swear it. You must know a way, some magic, some... Miramaz Dur sat back on her heels and studied Daenerys through eyes as black as night.
"'There is a spell,'
her voice was quiet, scarcely more than a whisper.
"'But it is hard, lady, and dark. Some would say that death is cleaner. I learned the way in a shy, and paid dear for the lesson. My teacher was a blood marsh from the Shadowlands.'
Danny went cold all over. "'Then you truly are a mage?'
"'Am I?'
Miramaz Dur smiled.
"'Only a mage can save your rider now, civil lady.'
"'Is there no other way?'
"'No other.'
Khal Drogo gave a shuddering gasp. "'Do it,' Danny blurted. She must not be afraid. She was the blood of the dragon. Save him.
"'There is a price,'
the god's wife warned her. "'You'll have gold, horses, whatever you like.'
"'It is not a matter of gold or horses. "'This is blood magic, lady. "'Only death may pay for life.'
"'Death?' "'Danny wrapped her arms around herself protectively, "'rocking back and forth on her heels. "'My death?' "'She told herself she would die for him, if she must. "'She was the blood of the dragon. "'She would not be afraid.' Her brother Rhaegar had died for the woman he loved.
No,
Miramaz Dur promised.
Not your death, Khaleesi.
Danny trembled with relief. Do it. The Maesha nodded solemnly.
As you speak, so it shall be done. Call your servants.
Khal Drogo writhed feebly as Rakaro and Quaro lowered him into the bath.
No,
he muttered.
No, must ride.
Once in the water, all the strength seemed to leak out of him.
Bring his horse,
Miramaz Dur commanded, and so it was done. Jogo led the great red stallion into the tent. When the animal caught the scent of death, he screamed and reared, rolling his eyes. It took three men to subdue him. What do you mean to do? Danny asked her.
We need the blood,
Mira answered.
That is the way.
Jogo edged back, his hand on his arrack. He was a youth of 16 years, whip-thin, fearless, quick to laugh, with a faint shadow of his first moustache on his upper lip. He fell to his knees before her. Khaleesi, he pleaded, you must not do this thing. Let me kill this Maesha. Kill her. "'And you kill your Khal,' Danny said. "'This is blood magic,' he said. "'It is forbidden. "'I am Khaleesi, and I say it is not forbidden. "'In Vaes Dothrak, Khal Drogo slew a stallion, "'and I ate his heart, to give our son strength and courage. "'This is the same. The same.' "'The stallion kicked and reared as Rakaro, Quaro, and Ego "'pulled him close to the tub, where the Khal floated like one already dead, pus and blood seeping from his wound to stain the bathwaters. Miramaz Dur chanted words in a tongue that Danny did not know, and a knife appeared in her hand. Danny never saw where it came from. It looked old, hammered red bronze, leaf-shaped, its blade covered with ancient glyphs. The Maesha drew it across the stallion's throat, under the noble head, and the horse screamed and shuddered as the blood poured out of him in a red rush. He would have collapsed, but the men of Hakaz held him up.
"Strength of the mount go into the rider,"
Mira sang, as horse blood swirled into the waters of Drogo's bath.
"Strength of the beast go into the man."
Jago looked terrified as he struggled with the stallion's weight, afraid to touch the dead flesh, yet afraid to let go as well. Only a horse, Danny thought. If she could buy Drogo's life with the death of a horse, she would pay 1,000 times over. When they let the stallion fall, the bath was a dark red, and nothing showed of Drogo but his face. Mirimar's door had no use for the carcass. "Burn it," Danny told them. It was what they did, she knew. When a man died, his mount was killed and placed beneath him on the funeral pyre to carry him to the Nightlands. The men of her cars dragged the carcass from the tent. The blood had gone everywhere. Even the sand silk walls were spotted with red, and the rugs underfoot were black and wet. Braziers were lit. Miri Mazdur tossed a red powder onto the coals. It gave the smoke a spicy scent, a pleasant enough smell. Yet Heroa fled, sobbing, and Danny was filled with fear. But she had gone too far to turn back now. She sent her handmaids away.
"Go with them, Silver Lady,"
Miramaz Dor told her. "I will stay," Danny said. "The man took me under the stars and gave life to the child inside me. I will not leave him."
"You must. Once I begin to sing, no one must enter this tent. My song will wake powers old and dark. The dead will dance here this night. No living man must look on them."
Danny bowed her head, helpless. "No one will enter." She bent over the tub, over Drogo in his bath of blood, and kissed him lightly on the brow. "Bring him back to me," she whispered to Miramar's door before she fled. Outside, the sun was low on the horizon, the sky a bruised red. The Khalasar had made camp. Tents and sleeping mats were scattered as far as the eye could see. A hot wind blew. Jogo and Ego were digging a fire pit to burn the dead stallion. A crowd had gathered to stare at Danny with hard black eyes, their faces like masks of beaten copper. She saw Sir Jorah Mormont, wearing mail and leather now, sweat beading on his broad, balding forehead. He pushed his way through the Dothraki to Danny's side. When he saw the scarlet footprints her boots had left on the ground, the colour seemed to drain from his face.
"What have you done, you little fool?"
he asked hoarsely. "I had to save him."
"We could have fled," he said. "I would have seen you safe to Ashai, princess. There was no need."
"Am I truly your princess?" she asked him.
"You know you are. God save us both."
"Then help me now." Sir Jorah grimaced.
"Would that I knew how."
Miramar's door's voice rose to a high, ululating wail that sent a shiver down Danny's back. Some of the Dothraki began to mutter and back away. The tent was aglow with the light of braziers within. Through the blood-spattered sand silk, she glimpsed shadows moving. Miramar's door was dancing, and not alone. Danny saw naked fear on the faces of the Dothraki.
"This must not be," Kotho thundered.
She had not seen the Blood Rider return. Hago and Kohalo were with him. They had brought the hairless men, the eunuchs who healed with knife and needle and fire.
"This will be," Danny replied. "May she," Hago growled.
"And old Kohalo." Kohalo, who had bound his life to Drogo's on the day of his birth. Kohalo, who had always been kind to her. Kohalo spat full in her face.
"You will die, Meiji," Kotho promised, "but the other must die first."
He drew his arrack and made for the tent.
"No,"
she shouted. "You mustn't." She caught him by the shoulder, but Kotho shoved her aside. Danny fell to her knees, crossing her arms over her belly to protect the child within. "Stop him," she commanded her cars. "Kill him." Rakaro and Quaro stood beside the TED flap. Quaro took a step forward, reaching for the handle of his whip. But Kotho spun, graceful as a dancer, the curved arak rising. It caught Quaro low under the arm, the bright, sharp steel biting up through leather and skin, through muscle and rib bone. Blood fountained as the young rider reeled backward, gasping. Kotho wrenched the blade free.
"Horse Lord," Sir Jorah Mormont called, "try me."
His long sword slid from its scabbard. Kotho whirled, cursing. The arak moved so fast that Quarrow's blood flew from it in a fine spray like rain in a hot wind. The long sword caught it, a foot from Sir Jorah's face, and held it quivering for an instant, as Kotho howled in fury. The knight was clad in chainmail, with gauntlets and greaves of lobstered steel, and a heavy gorget around his throat. But he had not thought to don his helm. Kotho danced backward, arak whirling around his head in a shining blur, flickering out like lightning, as the knight came on in a rush. Sir Jorah parried as best he could, but the slashes came so fast that it seemed to Dany that Kotho had four araks and as many arms. She heard the crunch of a sword on mail, saw sparks fly as the long, curved blade glanced off a gauntlet. Suddenly, it was Mormont stumbling backward, and Kotho leaping to the attack. The left side of the knight's face ran red with blood, and a cut to the hip opened a gash in his mail and left him limping. Kotho screamed taunts at him, calling him a craven, a milkman, a eunuch in an iron suit. "You die now," he promised, arak shivering through the red twilight. Inside Danny's womb, her son kicked wildly. The curved blade slipped past the straight one and bit deep into the knight's hip, where the mail gaped open. Mormont grunted, stumbled. Danny felt a sharp pain in her belly, a wetness on her thighs. Kotho shrieked triumph, but his arak had found bone, and for half a heartbeat it caught. It was enough. Sir Jorah brought his longsword down with all the strength left him, through flesh and muscle and bone, and Kotho's forearm dangled loose, flopping on a thin cord of skin and sinew. The knight's next cut was at the Dothraki's ear, so savage that Kotho's face seemed almost to explode. The Dothraki were shouting, Miramar's door wailing inside the tent like nothing human, Quaro pleading for water as he died. Danny cried out for help, but no one heard. Rakaro was fighting Hago, arak dancing with arak, until Jogo's whip cracked loud as thunder, the lash coiling around Hago's throat. A yank, and the blood rider stumbled backward, losing his feet and his sword. Rakaro sprang forward, howling, swinging his arak down with both hands through the top of Hago's head. The point caught between his eyes, red and quivering. Someone threw a stone, and when Danny looked, her shoulder was torn and bloody. "No," she wept. "No, please stop it. It's too high. The price is too high." More stones came flying. She tried to crawl towards the tent, but Kahalo caught her. Fingers in her hair, he pulled her head back, and she felt the cold touch of his knife at her throat. "My baby!" she screamed, and perhaps the guards heard. For as quick as that, Kahalo was dead. Aegor's arrow took him under the arm to pierce his lungs and heart. When at last Daenerys found the strength to raise her head, she saw the crowd dispersing, the Dothraki stealing silently back to their tents and sleeping mats. Some were saddling horses and riding off. The sun had set. Fires burned throughout the Khalasar, great orange blazes that crackled with fury and spit embers at the sky. She tried to rise,
An agony seized her, and squeezed her like a giant's fist. The breath went out of her. It was all she could do to gasp. The sound of Mirimar's door's voice was like a funeral dirge. Inside the tent, the shadows whirled. An arm went onto her waist, and then Ser Jorah was lifting her off her feet. His face was sticky with blood, and Dany saw that half his ear was gone. She convulsed in his arms as the pain took her again, and she heard the knight shouting for her handmaids to help him. "Are they also afraid?" She knew the answer. Another pain grasped her, and Dany bit back a scream. It felt as if her son had a knife in each hand, as if he were hacking at her to cut his way out. "Daria, curse you!" Ser Jorah roared. "Come here! Fetch the birthing women!" "They will not come. They say she is accursed." "They'll come, or I'll have their heads." Daria wept. "They are gone, my lord." "The Magi," someone else said. "Was that Aegor? Take her to the Magi." "No," Dany wanted to say. "No, not that. You mustn't." But when she opened her mouth, a long wail of pain escaped, and the sweat broke over her skin. What was wrong with them? Couldn't they see? Inside the tent, the shapes were dancing, circling the brazier and the bloody bath, dark against the sand silk, and some did not look human. She glimpsed the shadow of a great wolf, and another like a man wreathed in flames. "The lamb woman knows the secrets of the birthing bed," Ira said. "She said so. I heard her." "Yes," Doria agreed. "I heard her too." "No," she shouted. Or perhaps she only thought it, for no whisper of sound escaped her lips. She was being carried. Her eyes opened to gaze up at a flat, dead sky, black and bleak and starless. "Please, no." The sound of Miramar's door's voice grew louder, until it filled the world. "The shapes," she screamed. "The dancers!" Ser Jorah carried her inside the tent. Arya. The scent of hot bread, drifting from the shops along the street of flour, was sweeter than any perfume Arya had ever smelled. She took a deep breath and stepped closer to the pigeon. It was a plump one, speckled brown, busily pecking at a crust that had fallen between two cobblestones. But when Arya's shadow touched it, it took to the air. Her stick sword whistled out and caught it 2 feet off the ground, and it went down in a flurry of brown feathers. She was on it in the blink of an eye, grabbing a wing as a pigeon flapped and fluttered. It pecked at her hand. She grabbed its neck and twisted it until she felt the bone snap. Compared with catching cats, pigeons were easy. A passing septon was looking at her askance. "Here's the best place to find pigeon," Arya told him as she brushed herself off and picked up her fallen stick sword. "They come for the crumbs." He hurried away. She tied the pigeon to her belt and started down the street. A man was pushing a load of tarts by on a two-wheeled cart. The smells sang of blueberries and lemons and apricots. Her stomach made a hollow, rumbly noise. "Could I have one?" she heard herself say. "A lemon or any kind." The pushcart man looked her up and down. Plainly, he did not like what he saw. "3 coppers." Arya tapped her wooden sword against the side of her boot. "I'll trade you for a fat pigeon," she said. "The others take your pigeon," the pushcart man said. The tarts were still warm from the oven. The smells were making her mouth water, but she did not have 3 coppers, or 1. She gave the pushcart man
a look, remembering what Sirio had told her about seeing. He was short, with a little round belly, and when he moved, he seemed to favour his left leg a little. She was just thinking that if she snatched a tart and ran, he would never be able to catch her, when he said, "You be keeping your filthy hands off. The gold cloaks know how to deal with thieving little gutter rats. That they do." Arya glanced warily behind her. Two of the city watch were standing at the mouth of an alley. Their cloaks hung almost to the ground. The heavy wool dyed a rich gold. Their mail and boots and gloves were black. One wore a long sword at his hip, the other an iron cudgel. With a last wistful glance at the tarts, Arya edged back from the cart and hurried off. The gold cloaks had not been paying her any special attention, but the sight of them tied her stomach in knots. Arya had been staying as far from the castle as she could get, yet even from a distance she could see the heads rotting atop the high red walls, flocks of crows squabbling noisily over each head, thick as flies. The talk in Flea Bottom was that the gold cloaks had thrown in with the Lannisters, their commander raised to a lord, with lands on the Trident and a seat on the King's Council. She had also heard other things, scary things, things that made no sense to her. Some said her father had murdered King Robert, and had been slain in turn by Lord Renly. Others insisted that Renly had killed the king in a drunken quarrel between brothers. Why else should he have fled in the night like a common thief? One story said the king had been killed by a boar while hunting. Another said he'd died eating a boar, stuffing himself so full that he'd ruptured at the table. No, the king had died at table, others said, but only because Varys the spider poisoned him. No, it had been the queen who poisoned him. No, he had died of a pox. No, he had choked on a fishbone. One thing all the stories agreed on. King Robert was dead. The bells in the seven towers of the great Sept of Baelor had tolled for a day and a night, the thunder of their grief rolling across the city in a bronze tide. They only rang the bells like that for the death of a king, a tanner's boy told Arya. All she wanted was to go home, but leaving King's Landing was not so easy as she had hoped. Talk of war was on every lip, and gold cloaks were as thick on the city wall as fleas on, well, on her, for one. She had been sleeping in Flea Bottom, on rooftops and in stables, wherever she could find a place to lie down, and it hadn't taken her long to learn that the district was well named. Every day since her escape from the Red Keep, Arya had visited each of the seven city gates in turn. The Dragon Gate, the Lion Gate, and the Old Gate were closed and barred. The Mud Gate and the Gate of the Guards were open, but only to those who wanted to enter the city. The guards let no one out. Those who were allowed to leave left by the King's Gate or the Iron Gate, but Lannister men-at-arms in crimson cloaks and lion-crested helms man the guard posts there. Spying down from the roof of an inn by the King's Gate, Arya saw them searching wagons and carriages, forcing riders to open their saddlebags, and questioning everyone who tried to pass on foot. Sometimes she thought about swimming the river, but the Blackwater Rush was wide and deep, and everyone agreed that its currents were wicked and treacherous. She had no coin to pay a ferryman, or take passage on a ship. Her lord father had taught her never to steal, but it was growing harder to remember why. If she did not get out soon, she would have to take her chances with the gold cloaks. She hadn't gone hungry much since she learned to knock down birds with her stick sword, but she feared so much pigeon was making her sick. A couple she'd eaten raw before she found Flea Bottom. In the bottom there were pot shops along the alleys, where huge tubs of stew had been simmering for years, and you could trade half your bird for a heel of yesterday's bread and a bowl of brown. And they'd even stick the other half in the fire and crisp it up for you, so long as you pluck the feathers yourself. Arya would have given anything for a cup of milk and a lemon cake. But the brown wasn't so bad. It usually had barley in it, and chunks of carrot and onion and turnip, and sometimes even apple, with a film of grease swimming on top. Mostly, she tried not to think about the meat. Once, she had gotten a piece of fish. The only thing was, the pot shops were never empty. And even as she bolted down her food, Arya could feel them watching. Some of them stared at her boots or her cloak, and she knew what they were thinking. With others, she could almost feel their eyes crawling under her leathers. She didn't know what they were thinking, and that scared her even more. A couple times, she was followed out into the alleys and chased, but so far, no one had been able to catch her. The silver bracelet she had hoped to sell had been stolen her first night out of the castle, along with her bundle of good clothes, snatched while she slept in a burnt-out house off Pig Alley. All they left her was the cloak she had been huddled in, the leathers on her back, her wooden practice sword, and Needle. She'd been lying on top of Needle, or else it would have been gone too. It was worth more than all the rest together. Since then, Arya had taken to walking round with her cloak draped over her right arm to conceal the blade at her hip. The wooden sword she carried in her left hand, out where everybody could see it, to scare off robbers. But there were men in the pot shops who wouldn't have been scared off if she'd had a battle axe. It was enough to make her lose her taste for pigeon and stale bread. Often as not, she went to bed hungry, rather than risk the stairs. Once she was outside the city, she would find berries to pick, or orchards she might raid for apples and cherries. Arya remembered seeing some from the King's Road on the journey south, and she could dig for roots in the forest, even run down some rabbits. In the city, the only things to run down were rats and cats and scrawny dogs. The pot shops would give you a fistful of coppers for a litter of pups, she heard, but she didn't like to think about that. Down below the Street of Flour was a maze of twisting alleys and cross streets. Arya scrambled through the crowds, trying to put distance between her and the gold cloaks. She had learned to keep to the center of the street. Sometimes she had to dodge wagons and horses, but at least you could see them coming. If you walked near the buildings, people grabbed you. In some alleys, you couldn't help but brush against the walls. The buildings leaned in so close they almost met. A whooping gang of small children went running past, chasing a rolling hoop. Arya stared at them with resentment, remembering the times she'd played at hoops with Bran and John and their baby brother Rickon. She wondered how big Rickon had grown, and whether Bran was sad. She would have given anything if John had been here to call her little sister and muss her hair. Not that it needed mussing. She'd seen her reflection in puddles, and she didn't think hair got any more mussed than hers. She had tried talking to the children she saw on the street, hoping to make a friend who would give her a place to sleep. But she must have talked wrong or something. The little ones only looked at her with quick, wary eyes and ran away if she came too close. Their big brothers and sisters asked questions Arya couldn't answer, called her names, and tried to steal from her. Only yesterday, a scrawny, barefoot girl twice her age had knocked her down and tried to pull her boots off her feet. But Arya gave her a crack on the ear with her stick sword that sent her off sobbing and bleeding. A gull wheeled overhead as she made her way down the hill toward Flea Bottom. Arya glanced at it thoughtfully, but it was well beyond the reach of her stick. It made her think of the sea. Maybe that was the way out. Old Nan used to tell stories of boys who stowed away
on trading galleys, and sailed off into all kinds of adventures. Maybe Arya could do that too. She decided to visit the riverfront. It was on the way to the mud